Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 29th of November, a potentially dramatic day as MPs accepted the principle of assisted dying in England and Wales. We've devoted the whole of this edition to the subject. We hear contributions from MPs inside the Commons, and I was outside Parliament with those on either side of the argument waiting anxiously for the result. We also hear from a doctor with a seat in the Lords who thinks the bill can be improved, from a bishop on the effect of the legislation on our concept of death, and the historian's Sir Dunlop and Sir Anthony Seldon discuss how proposed laws like this one, emanating not from an election manifesto or a government and piloted by a backbench MP, have generated many of Britain's most important social changes.
The ayes to the right, 330. The noes to the left, 275. The ayes have it, and look!
In the end, the result was decisive. Just before 2:30 this afternoon, following nearly 5 hours of discussion, MPs approved the principle of assisted dying. The debate before the vote was serious, at times deeply personal, passionate but respectful. We're devoting the whole of this edition of The World Tonight to this issue, so you'll hear some of MPs' contributions in a little while. We'll also hear from one of the many listeners who've been in contact with the programme on this subject over the last few months, from those who have campaigned for this result and those who hoped for a different outcome. We'll discuss how private members' bills have often acted as an engine for social change, and we'll ask whether this one radically alters the relationship between the individual and the state. First, though, reaction to the result from the promoter of the bill, Labour's Kim Leadbeater.
There will be line-by-line scrutiny. And if there are genuine concerns, which I know there are from some MPs on a range of different issues, let's have that debate, let's have that conversation. That's why I've said I will take evidence at the Bill Committee, and the debate continues. I was very clear that this is the start of the process. The media were less clear about that. They thought we were going to change the law tomorrow. But there's a long way to go now, and I want to take colleagues with me on that journey and continue the conversations, not just about this really important issue, but also about palliative care and about the rights of disabled people and about the NHS and social care and all those other things that we talked about today. You know, my head is full of all those speeches with all those ideas, and as parliamentarians we've got a duty to address them all.
She was speaking to Newsnight's political editor Nick Watt, who also spoke to the principal speaker against her bill, the Conservative MP Danny Kruger.
Well, I'm very disappointed by the results, but I'm reassured by the debate, which was a very good one, I thought, and I'm pleased that so many members who voted for the bill this afternoon said so. They were only doing so on condition that the bill improves. They recognise that there are serious loopholes, serious weaknesses in these safeguards to protect the most vulnerable people. Those are substantial in my view. I'm worried that we're not going to be able to improve them, but a lot of colleagues have said they're going to try their hardest in committee, and when it comes back to the chamber in a few months' time, I want to hold them to their word. I hope they've managed to do that. And if they don't, if the bill is not strong enough, not safe, then they should vote against it when it comes back.
That was Danny Kruger. Just to be clear, if this bill does become law, it will change the situation in England and Wales, but not in Northern Ireland or Scotland. Both the Secretary of State for Scotland and the SNP observed the convention not to vote on laws that do not apply in their constituencies. However, other MPs with seats in Scotland did vote, as did many of those from Northern Ireland. Ministers were given a free vote. Among those in favour, Sir Keir Starmer. Among those against, his deputy, Angela Rayner. Well, Fridays at Westminster are usually pretty quiet, with many MPs holding surgeries in their constituencies and only tourists hanging around outside. The atmosphere I found at Westminster this lunchtime would have left any visitor with few doubts, though, that this was a very important day. Now, by the hands of Big Ben, it's a little after 1:30, and I'm standing directly across the road from the parliamentary entrance with a group of people who are trying to lobby against this bill. Somebody has actually erected a rather fearsome-looking papier-mâché judge wielding a giant syringe just next to the statue of George V. There are probably about 100 or so people here, which, of course, is rather more than will have got the opportunity to speak in the debate inside the Commons. The atmosphere there is very serious. There's a sense of the gravity of the debate. For once, the whips won't count, which makes you ask the question why the protesters have come here in the hope that they will.
Yeah. I'm Lisa Hammond. I am an actor and a writer, and I'm here today because I'm passionately opposed to the assisted dying bill. I think it puts people in a really dangerous situation, especially disabled and vulnerable people. People say it's got nothing to do with us. It has everything to do with us.
Now, across the road to the other side of Westminster, where the other side of the debate is represented by a group of ladies here who are wearing bright pink jumpers and hats. They're from Campaign for Dignity and Dying. Tell me who you are and why you've come today.
I came through this through witnessing both my parents having extremely protracted deaths and my father having begged me to help him finish it many, many times.
We've got about 45 minutes until the vote, judging by Big Ben, which has just signalled the quarter of hour. Let me talk to the lady next to you. What's your name?
My name's Sheena, and I work with patients with stomach cancer in the charitable sector. To die from any digestive cancer is a horribly painful death. So for me, this is an issue of kindness. It's about dignity. It's about humanity.
As the chants continue outside, I'm just watching, like a lot of people are on their mobile phones, the coverage from inside the chamber. It's absolutely packed. Oh, here comes the speaker.
The eyes to the right, 330. The nose to the left, 275.
So the bill has been given its second reading, which will be a major disappointment for people standing here campaigning for the legislation to be killed off at this point.
So this is a sad day, but it's not the end, because we who are here will continue to contend. We're going to continue to speak life.
I'm back with Lisa Hammond, who we spoke to earlier. Lisa, your reaction to it?
I'm gutted, to be honest. I thought it would be much closer. I share the sentiments of all my disabled colleagues, friends that are all here today. It's a very sad day for us.
I think the peal of bells from one of the churches on the edge of Parliament Square is probably a coincidence, but the mood on this side of the square is undoubtedly more upbeat, more delighted, more jubilant indeed, with people hugging each other, smiling, kissing, sending the message to each other on their phones. The supporters of this legislation are gathered in the shadow of the statue of Millicent Fawcett, one of the campaigners for Votes for Women, holding up her sign, Courage Calls to Courage Everywhere.
Euphoric, absolutely euphoric. We've fought for this for so many years, and it's just a magical moment.
I cried because we've been campaigning for this for 10 years. I'm a doctor. I know what end of life means for some people. You know, cruel, horrible things. And people have got a choice now. It's along there with capital punishment ending, decriminalising homosexuality, abortion. It's a huge social change, and we absolutely welcome it. It's fantastic.
Flavour there of the mood outside Parliament. Here's today in Parliament's Alicia McCarthy with some of what was being said inside the Commons.
The chamber was packed as the session got underway, with MPs crammed onto the benches for the day's debate. More than 160 of them had asked to speak, and there were passionately held views on both sides. The longest-serving female MP, the mother of the House, Labour's Diane Abbott, worried about the safeguards in the bill. She argued there wasn't enough protection for the vulnerable.
To protect them from predatory relatives, to protect them from the state, but above all, to protect them from themselves. There will be those who say to themselves they don't want to be a burden. And I can imagine myself saying that in particular circumstances. Others will worry that assets they had hoped to leave for their grandchildren are being eroded by the cost of care. And there will even be a handful who will think they should not be taking up a hospital bed.
From the opposite side of the Commons, the Conservative and longest-serving male MP, the father of the House, Sir Edward Lee, also opposed the bill. He said the argument couldn't just be seen in terms of individual cases, but should be looked at in terms of what it meant for society.
What sort of society are we? Are we a society that loves our NHS, that loves life, that loves caring, that loves the hospice movement? Or are we a society which believes that there is despair? So I will be voting for hope at 2:30, and I will be voting against this bill. Yeah.
Another opponent of the legislation, Labour MP Florence Eshalomi, argued true compassion should have equality at its heart. And she said the hard truth was that health inequalities were wide and persistent, and that black and minority ethnic disabled people had far worse health outcomes than the national average.
I've seen this firsthand. Caring for my mother, who suffered with sickle cell anemia. As a teenager, I would be by her side when she was in excruciating pain, explaining to a doctor who would not believe her when she told them she needed life-saving medication. And sadly, this is still the reality today.
And she added,
put simply, Madam Deputy Speaker, we should be helping people to live comfortable, pain-free lives on their own terms before we think about making it easier for them to die.
But the bill's backers spoke equally passionately in favour. Luke Evans, a Conservative MP and doctor, argued there were conditions palliative care couldn't help. He gave the example of one type of cancer which eroded the arteries in the neck.
And do you know what modern medicine's answer to that is? Keep dark towels nearby for the blood. Counsel a partner or family on what it's like to find someone bleeding out. There is no cure. There's no respite. What would you do? Currently for these patients, we can offer no agency over their end. No alternative to this terrifying death. Can we truly say that's compassionate? So I ask you, should we not even offer those suffering at least the chance of dignity in their death?
Catherine Fuchs, a Labour member, spoke about her sister-in-law who developed bone cancer, something the MP described as particularly painful and unforgiving. But as she lived in Victoria in Australia, she was able to register for assisted dying.
For her, that was incredibly comforting. To know that if she needed to, and only if, she could stop the suffering. She didn't need it in the end, but she did have the option. And in her darkest days, and her fearful days, that brought her and my brother incredible peace of mind.
Liberal Democrat Vicky Slade was the last backbencher to speak in the debate and, like several other MPs, read out the story of one of her constituents.
Gary lives in my constituency of Mid Dorset and North Poole, and he asked me to tell you his story of dying with liver cancer. He knows the end stages will be brutal and he wants to decide when enough is enough. Gary told me, death does not worry me at all. Dying a slow death with my dignity stripped away terrifies me. So when my time is right, I will kill myself, alone and afraid. My sick dog will not have to die alone and afraid. I am forced to do so.
Vicky Slade MP quoting her constituent Gary, ending that report from Alicia McCarthy at Westminster. Today in Parliament, we'll be playing more of the debate at 11:30. This evening. But this is a debate that has generated a huge amount of reaction from our listeners. Many of you have been in touch with your own stories. One of the people who contacted us was Jill Gerrish. Jill has severe progressive multiple sclerosis and lives in a care home. She was able to speak to us this afternoon with the help of her carer, and Jill told us why the result gives her hope.
I am obviously delighted. I have primary progressive MS that was diagnosed when I was 54, I'm now 71. It's been getting steadily worse. Currently, I am 90% paralyzed. The only moving parts are my right hand and my head, and my brain seems to work. I have a DNR in place and was assessed as completely compass mentis some years ago and was told by the psychiatrist who assessed me that if he could help me, he would, but of course he can't. I've had an extremely full life and I'm not depressed. My sense of humour is good, but I've just had enough.
Our thanks to Jill. and her carer for that interview. Well, Dame Prue Leith, the restaurateur, made a Channel 4 documentary on assisted dying with her son, the Conservative MP Danny Kruger. As we heard earlier, he's been an eloquent opponent of the change. She is in favour. As recently as last night, Dame Prue was part of a group lobbying MPs at Westminster. So how did she react to today's result?
I'm relieved and delighted. I really am. I think it's been a good debate, both sides being sort of intelligent and respectful and, you know, not horrible.
Has it been a better debate than you were expecting?
Much better, much better. I'm absolutely thrilled because it's been a long haul. I mean, I've been at this for 10 years now. So it feels like a huge relief.
Partly informed by your own personal experience.
Yes, I mean, my brother died about 10 years ago, 12 years ago. So, and it's been ever since that I've been agitating to get the law changed. So.
What was it about what you went through with him and what he experienced personally that made you feel so strongly about this?
Well, at that time, the thing that was driving me was just sheer rage. I mean, anger. I couldn't believe that the establishment, in this case, a National Health Hospital, could be so uncaring about one of their patients, or in fact, all of their patients, that they could just think that it was their job to keep him alive, even though he didn't want to be kept alive. You know, we make decisions all the time about how we should live our lives, and we're encouraged to. I mean, government, by and large, says, you know, you must take responsibility for your own actions. You must look after yourself. And then when the most important decision of your life comes along, the fact that you want to leave it, suddenly, oh, no, that's not for you to decide.
You obviously hope that what your brother experienced will in the future not happen to others if they choose this course. And you've been around the world looking at examples in a TV series with your son, Danny Kruger, of course, is an MP, and spoke very eloquently from an entirely different position. I suppose the first thing I should ask you, were you proud of him today?
I was. I thought he made a very good speech. I don't agree with it, but I think he did very well. And he has, you know, he has rallied a lot of support. In fact, he became a really formidable opponent. I was quite worried the last few days because especially the younger members of Parliament, I was really concerned about them because I felt some of them are quite new to Parliament, and wouldn't it be easier to just either go for the status quo? You can't be blamed very much for just allowing the law to continue as it was, or to abstain. And it would be the easiest thing to do because obviously in every constituency, there will be people who are opposed. Not very many, but there will be some. So I was there last night with a bunch of MPs and supporters in Parliament trying to say, just this is a point at which you have to be courageous. And, you know, if you believe that an assisted death is a humane and proper thing to do, you have to be brave enough to vote for it.
That was
Dame. You just can't duck the responsibility. And they didn't.
That was Dame Prue Leith. Well, joining us now is the Right Reverend Michael Beazley, Anglican Bishop of Bath and Wells. Bishop Beazley, thank you for being with us on The World Tonight. What's your assessment of where this vote, the result, leaves this whole debate?
The debate today was in depth from all sides. People spoke with great passion and great emotion. And from the depths of their hearts. As somebody who opposed the bill, I think where it would leave somebody like myself and others that would share the views that I have is that what really matters now is what happens in the scrutiny of the bill in its next stage. On both sides of the debate today, there was much spoken about the need for really good safeguards for the vulnerable, those who may feel that they need to accept assisted dying because they feel themselves a burden or are told that they are a burden, or those who may be coerced into making use of this. So I think what's really going to be important next is the safeguarding scrutiny that's going to be put in for the next stages, and that I hope that MPs will think about really carefully and then about whether they vote in the next stages of the bill when that comes.
For our society, do you think we've crossed the Rubicon with this?
I think that's a concern that I would have. I think this very much changes the relationship of the state with its citizens. I think also once the principle of assisted dying or assisted suicide, depending on which you see it, is accepted, then of course there is concern that in other jurisdictions there has been a progressive extension of the provisions of this kind of legislation. And that is something about which I think we should be rightly worried.
In a sense, part of the debate itself. And I don't want to kind of go back over ground too much of that. But if you think about the life experience of many people in this country, churches, temples, synagogues, mosques play a part in the lives of many people when they are dealing with the death of a loved one or when they're preparing for their own death. Even for people who don't have a faith or are not practicing a faith. Do you think this will significantly change that relationship?
I don't think it will change that relationship. I think when we face the really difficult times in our lives, if we're people of faith, certainly, but also for people who are not of faith, we reach out for something bigger. And the church will always be there for those in that situation.
But certainly in the case of the Church of England, it is, a state religion. It's the kind of official expression of faith in this country, even though many people are not its adherents any longer. And many were not in the first place, even when it was created. Does its relationship with society, is it altered by this?
I don't think this will fundamentally change the relationship of people in England with the Church of England. We cover every part of the country with our parish system. We are there for all people who live within an area, no matter what their perspective or what their view is. Our job is to be welcome and open to the support of all.
Bishop Michael Beazley, Anglican Bishop of Bath and Wells. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. With me is our political editor, Chris Mason. It was a momentous day, regardless of your view on the issue. What's your assessment of what we saw in the Commons?
I was really struck, Sean, sitting in the press gallery for several hours this morning, that Parliament today wore the magnitude of this with a deep self-awareness. Parliament was at its thoughtful, expansive, passionate best. It was a wildly atypical day in Parliament because the prism of party loyalty didn't matter, or at least didn't matter as much. And I think part of that sense of the magnitude for so many MPs, and remember, the majority of MPs have only been there since July, was the sense that this moment has the potential, and we should emphasise that this proposed change in the law is not there yet. Its proponents have a lot of arguing to do, and those who are not keen on it point out rightly that it could still be stopped. But there is that potential historical parallel to so many of those huge social changes of the last half century or a century. You think back to banning of capital punishment in the mid-1960s. You think of the Abortion Act in 1967, introduced by David Steele, Lord Steele, via a private member's bill, using that same mechanism for the delivery of colossal social change. And both of those examples, the death penalty and the Abortion Act, and then the debate today, are about that fundamental, aren't they? The fundamental of the role of the state in life and death. And there are other more contemporary parallels, social changes. You think of the legalisation of homosexual sex, and then fast forward a generation and the legalisation of gay marriage. Neither are about life and death, but profound social change. And if Parliament manages to attach an interest and a concern for a social change that also has the fair wind, if you like, of public opinion behind it, often what happens is that it stands the test of time. It becomes that social change that isn't shifted by future parliaments and future generations. We don't know if this is going to be the case in this instance, because 2025 will be the stage on which the arguments are fought.
Chris Mason, our political editor, thank you very much. And I should say that on exactly that question, the role in particular of backbench bills in changing public opinion, or arguably resulting from a change of public opinion, we'll be discussing that with Sir Anthony Seldon and Tessa Dunlop in just a few moments. I should also say that if you need support for any of the issues that we're discussing in this programme, a list of organisations that can help is available at bbc.co.uk/actionline. Actionline is one word. You're listening to The World Tonight. One other story for us tonight. Polls have closed in the last half hour in Ireland in the country's general election. The BBC's Chris Page is in Dublin. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening. Yes, the voting did finish at 10 o'clock. And we have, in the last few minutes, just had the exit poll carried out by the Irish national broadcaster RTE, the Irish Times, and academics from Trinity College Dublin. And the poll suggests that the race for first preference votes is very tight indeed between the three main parties. It gives Sinn Féin a very narrow lead of 21.1% over Fine Gael on 21%, and Fianna Fáil, the third main party, on 19.5%. So there's really very little between the three parties whose leaders are the contenders to be the Prime Minister or Taoiseach. They are Fine Gael, led by Simon Harris, who's been in the job for just the last 7 months. His main coalition partner, Micheál Martin of Fianna Fáil, who's also Taoiseach earlier in the government's term, and Mary Lou MacDonald of Sinn Féin. Now, her party has been the main opposition group in Dublin since the last general election, and during that time it's also become the largest political party in Northern Ireland. And if Sinn Féin were to take power here in Dublin, well, it would push hard for a referendum on Irish unity by 2030. However, even if Sinn Féin did win the most seats in the Irish Parliament for the first time, it would still, I think, have an uphill task in assembling a coalition of other left-wing parties that would command an overall majority. So that could leave the way open for the coalition led by the two centrist parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, to go into government again. The counting will begin in the morning. First preference votes first. That will give us the general direction. Then we'll be into, on Sunday perhaps, transfers, second, third, fourth preferences. Very tight margins between victory and defeat in the 174 seats being contested. We're in for a fascinating few days.
Indeed, a very long weekend for you. Chris Page in Dublin, thank you very much. Now, the vote on the bill today at Westminster is not the end of the parliamentary process of assisted dying. It has to go through the same process as any proposed government bill. The next stage involves a committee, and here comes the first key difference. Membership will be determined by the bill's author and weighted according to today's result, so more pro than anti, rather than between government and opposition parties. After this detailed consideration, the committee reports back to the House with any suggested amendments that MPs then vote on before the bill is considered in the House of Lords. Professor Lord Robert Winston, a Labour peer, is an obstetrician known for his work on fertility and as the presenter of TV series including Child of Our Time and Your Life in Their Hands. He's one of many peers interested in the details of the bill and how it might be amended. I asked him first, though, to react to MPs approving the principle, at least, of assisted dying.
Well, I tell you what really impresses me is that the House was totally full. There were, I think, all but 25 MPs actually voting in this bill, which is extraordinary. There must be some extensions, but obviously they felt this was very important. My own feeling is that it's not nearly quite as important as, you know, has been suggested, because I don't think it fundamentally changes humanity. It doesn't change our society in the way that people are claiming. I think it's an important piece of humanity, actually. And I think it's good that they have voted in a humane way. As you probably know, I've changed my view over many years. 30 years ago, when this first came up in the Lords, I was very concerned about it. I'm much less concerned now. I think there still are some concerns, but I think it's an interesting vote, and I'm pleased it's gone this far.
Has your faith in any way informed your view on this subject?
Well, it might inform, and of course it informs everybody, you know, because everybody has different beliefs. What I don't think you do as a parliamentarian, if you're wise, is to actually impose your faith on somebody else. And I think, unfortunately, in this debate, that did happen a bit. I didn't hear the whole debate, but sometimes I did hear, as in the past, people with a strong religious view kind of dictating that religious view to people who wouldn't share it. And therefore, I think they, in a sense, should exclude themselves. By all means, speak, but they shouldn't be voting.
This bill will have to be considered by the House of Lords as well as, again, by the House of Commons. In what way, when it comes to the Lords, would you like to see this bill amended, altered, changed, developed?
For me, the really big sticking point is the issue of the High Court judge and the use of the judiciary in this bill. I don't think there's any place for that. And I think it's a mistake, because as soon as you introduce the law, you will introduce all sorts of judicial review that might be asked by different people who are related or by, you know, that. And I think once you start to involve the courts in medical decisions, as we've seen again and again historically, you have problems. And I think it isn't very helpful. The other thing, of course, is that having a judge decide to give assent will delay, even if it's a short time. And actually, that's a very cruel thing to do. If people have actually gone through this process and they've seen two general practitioners or special medical practitioners and have thought about this at long length, you don't really should expect them to be hanging on tenterhooks to get a final legal rubber stamp, even if it is a rubber stamp. And I think that there is no justification for that. And I think actually it does tend on being potentially rather cruel.
How do you think the Lords should approach this? Because presumably the feelings will be every bit as strong on either side of the argument there as they have been expressed in the Commons.
I think they will. But on the other hand, I do think that one of the good things about the House of Lords, and it's one reason why we do, I hope to some extent, value it, is because the Lords is actually at its strongest and most effective when it's considering ethical arguments. You know, ethics don't stand still. The whole thing of our ethical values, it depends really on societal values and normative values, and they change over time. You know, 200 to 300 years ago, somebody saw under a microscope a little man inside the sperm, and therefore some theologians said this was like murder if you masturbated. We now know there's no little man inside the sperm because the science has moved on. And although that's a rather crude example, it is true that ethics does change depending on your knowledge and your values. And I think we have to understand that.
The peer, Lord Robert Winston. Well, as Chris Mason was reflecting just now, the assisted dying bill is the latest example of a single backbencher beginning a process which could alter society well beyond those it directly affects.
In 2.5 hours from now, we shall know whether or not hanging for murder is likely to be abolished in Great Britain. At this moment, the House of Commons is locked in debate on capital punishment. There'll be a free vote at 11 o'clock.
It's still a crime in Britain for male homosexuals to make love, but with a reform bill waiting to be given a third reading in the House of Commons, prosecutions now are rare.
And we do not condone homosexuality. What the House of Commons has decided is that the homosexual has enough troubles without, in addition, having the fear and insecurity and the blackmail that arises from the existing law.
The impact of the Abortion Act was really just sheer relief of the terror of getting pregnant. It didn't mean people rushed out and got pregnant and didn't care about contraception. Quite the opposite.
Just some examples of those social changes resulting from one MP taking on a challenge government had ignored. Have these, though, been cases of legislation as catalyst or public attitude subsequently changing because the law had done so already? Well, joining me, the historian and author Tessa Dunlop and the political historian Sir Anthony Seldon, whose books include volumes on the work of British Prime Ministers from John Major to Liz Truss. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being with us on this very important day. Sir Anthony, first of all, this was a backbench piece of legislation. We think of the Wilson government in the 60s. It's probably fair to say that the things that are most memorable from those governments in the 60s are actually these changes by backbenchers. Is there a parallel we can draw here with this case?
Well, they're different, aren't they? I mean, it was capital punishment, it was homosexuality, it was abortion, it was the voting age coming down to 18, divorce, and it was a whole range of things, open university, also similar liberalizing moves. But it was very much in the zeitgeist and the spirit of the age with an associated, although most of them were private, members' bills on free votes. It was in the spirit of the age and in the spirit that the Wilson government wanted the country to go, and very much associated with the Home Secretary of the day, Roy Jenkins. So there was a kudos and a benefit to the government, which there won't necessarily be, even if, as is likely perhaps, it gets through the third reading and becomes an act. And in two or so years' time, then people will be able to take advantage of the assisted dying. But it's different. It's different, and it's consuming an awful lot of energy in a government that is yet to find its narrative. It isn't totally clear what, you know, we knew what the Wilson government stood for. We don't yet know what the Starmer government stands for.
Tessa Dunlop, I'm interested in things when you look at those examples, like retiring the hangman and the hangman's noose, banishing the backstreet abortionist, stopping the state harassment of gay men who have sex. Not all those measures were exactly popular at the time they were taken. Was there a sense that Parliament changed public opinion, or that Parliament was catching up with a change that was already underway?
Well, it's very interesting. Of course, it entirely depends who you talk to. I spent a lot of time with Anne Baer. She died at 107, and she had, as she reminded me, been in her 50s in the 60s, a keen friend of the Labour Health Minister, Kenneth Robinson. And she was an artist. She'd been in the 1930s. Oh, well, I knew fine well, she would say, if a man was queer, I used to know that that wasn't going to be one for me. And we thought it was absolutely ridiculous. And that was in the 30s. And what happens is you got this very conservative government in the 1950s, where actually you saw convictions against homosexual acts increase 5-6 times in comparison.
This was,
say,
despite
the
Wolfenden report, which had proposed liberalising the law.
Indeed. In fact, the Wolfenden report came in and was conducted in 1954 precisely because there was grave concern over the number of prosecutions because there'd been this spike. But the Wolfenden report didn't get a reading until 1960. It recommended partial decriminalisation. It also recommended steeper penalties for public offences. Only the latter occurred. You still didn't get the legalisation of gay sex. That happened over 10 years after the Wolfenden report had been commissioned. And what's interesting is why it took so long. And I believe that, and Anthony would know this better than me, but we predominantly have been governed by Conservatives. I think something like 60 years in the 100 of the 20th century were Conservative administrations. So therefore, there was this kind of dam bursting effect when you get the Labour administration coming along in the mid-60s. Suddenly there's a sort of catch-up moment.
So, Anthony, just on that point, 330 votes against changing the law 9 years ago, 330 votes in favour of changing it today. Has public opinion moved that far? And if it hasn't, what are the implications, do you think, for this government? And I'll ask you to be fairly brief if you can.
Well, I don't think we yet know exactly why there has been such a significant change in the voting of MPs. Many of them are new to Parliament, so that's a factor. We're much more aware of the 2/3 plus of the population who support assisted dying in some form. Is that a factor? Was indeed even, you know, the enormously popular Esther Ransom, with her very, very long association with many people's lives, was that a factor? If you have that kind of a person coming in, so I think it's a number of things. I think it's it's partly, as Tessa's saying, you know, zeitgeist now. It just feels right now in a way that it didn't in 2015 or 1997, which is when it had been considered before. So. And the moment has come, as Robert Winston was also suggesting.
Sir Anthony Seldon and Tessa Dunlop, I'd love to talk more. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Just to confirm our closing headline, MPs have voted by a majority of 55 in favour of allowing assisted dying for terminally ill adults in England and Wales. That's The World Tonight. Good night.